Welcome to the Rand CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
What's up, everyone? This is Dylan Marma bringing to you the Rand Partners podcast, joined by my co-host, Mike Taravella. How are you doing today, Mike?
You know, just living the dream, making it happen, Dylan. And just super excited to bring on our great friend of ours from the real estate world and just covering a lot of awesome materials on this wonderful Friday.
I am very excited as well. I know today's going to be a powerful show. It's someone that we've been waiting for quite some time now. Before we get started, we always want to remind you the RAND CRE show is hosted by RAND Commercial Real Estate. We are a vertically integrated investment and advisory firm providing opportunities for investors to create passive streams of income through real estate investing, as well as providing active investors with sourcing, debt, and equity across the board. So if you have any questions about how to fund your next deal, or if you'd like to partner with us through investing passively, you can always reach us at randcre.com.
And so today's guest is a good friend of ours. We've learned a lot from masterminds and being on our podcast in the past, Omar Khan. Omar is responsible for capital raising, strategic planning, and investor relations. He has over 10 years of global investment experience. He has participated in capital financing and mergers and acquisition transactions valued at $3.7 billion. He is a CFA charter holder and graduated with honors from the University of Toronto with a business commerce and, or BCom in finance.
Yeah, it's a lot of things. Don't worry about it. That was a long time ago. I graduated. That's the news. I graduated on time.
Welcome to the show, Omar.
Hey, thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was actually impressed with how succinct your bio was as a whole. I thought that you guys on the website did pretty well with that.
People tend thank you. No, you only want to highlight the good parts. None of the bad parts.
The laundry list of experience and greatness.
Yeah, well, some of this was because I was really passionate about never being broke and poor. So some of these jobs weren't taken because I like doing a job because I hate working. Some of these jobs were just because they were nice, high-paying jobs. And you're like, well, it's not too bad. It's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So Omar, what's, I guess, the latest in your business in the last couple months?
Well, we're closing on a deal actually to round out the year. Actually, it's supposed to be either today or Monday we'll close it out in Atlanta. It's a 194 Class B unit deal. Took us a little while. We only did two deals. So with this, we're only going to be doing two deals this year. We had the dry powder and the money to go get more deals. But frankly, a lot of those aren't really, you know, they don't fall from the sky every now and then. So whereas it's a nice problem, you have at least a portion of the capital stack ready to go and all that kind of stuff. Finding these is becoming harder and harder, and especially the markets that we want to be in, particular pockets of Florida, Texas, and Georgia now. So, you know, our model is more towards, like, say, bigger cities, so far at least, not towards the smaller cities, and it's got to be at least 20 million plus. So, you know, it's harder and harder, but I mean, that's what people pay us for, right? So why complain about that?
Yeah, that's it's a great point and something I definitely want to hit on. We actually thought about doing a video or a podcast just on why we've only done two deals this year, because we're in a similar position where the deal flow has been a challenge. I think in the beginning of the year, we set the goal at four or five deals, but it's just more so just a matter of looking at many deals and not having something that really scratches out to hit our overall target returns.
Well, you could do four or five deals. You just chose not to do them.
Right. And that's always what we run into as investors, right? You set your goals, but if you have strong parameters, they're fighting against you the entire time. I mean, they act as a bumper to make sure you're doing the right deals.
Yeah, but look, the good deal is the smart thing that I think you guys have done also, like us, is it's very easy to get into these deals if you're really eager to get into one of these deals and you've got the money. My God, it's super hard to get out of these things, right? It's not like a stock where you have the convenience where you can log on to your brokerage, things will work out, you might take a 5% haircut, right? And at least you're out of it, right? The pain and misery is over. This is like, man, if you get stuck with a bad deal, that's an albatross around your neck. I mean, you just get weighed down and life sucks and everything sucks and everybody sucks. It's just like a cancerous thing in your life. Mm-hmm. So it's a smart move you guys did, right?
And you have investors reaching out. Hey, when's the next deal? Hey, I haven't heard from you in a while, right? And it's, you know, there's always a little level of pressure that I think as sponsors you fight.
Oh, no, it's funny actually you're saying that. Just last night, I had a guy on pretty much every deal gives you 200 grand. He's a really nice friend of mine also. And he's like, a lot of times what happens is when I'm in between deals, because he's getting deals, so it's very fluid individual. So he'll send me some decks. He'd be like, what do you think about this deal? And a lot of those deals are actually very nice. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I think you should go for these guys, right? And you look them up, and they're very reputable. But yesterday he sent me some person who wants to do a fund. They kind of have some experience, not really. And they just want to do lots of deals. And I was like, dude, this is a big red flag. You need to get the hell out of here. And he's like, well, what's your pipeline? I was like, well, if I knew that, I'd be a pretty rich guy, you know, but I don't know the future. So you're right. It, developing a pipeline takes a little while. And even then, when you get there, then you realize, oh, there's 500 things I can do. So it's a continuous challenge, I think, but it's a good problem to have.
Yeah. And I think having that crystal ball, everyone asks, when is it going to crash? When is it going to correct? And it's always that crystal ball of trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future, but kind of backing up on the exit strategy. How do you exit the strategy, exit the property? What are some things you key in on when examining a property and having the business units and the business strategy in place so that you can have a favorable exit?
Look, in my particular case, so this obviously might not apply to every one of your listeners, or I guess maybe it does. We are only operating in bigger cities, right? Say Atlanta, San Antonio, Austin, Jacksonville, right?
More liquid.
Or more liquid markets, right? So bigger means more liquid typically. So, and we're typically operating as, especially as we're growing, more and more in the B plus sort of areas, right? So that is a very highly liquid market. Now, does that mean you'll never make a loss? No, you will make a loss if you do dumb things. But the ability for an operator to get out of that deal is infinitely higher than, say, if you were to buy some, even a very nice deal in, say, a really small town somewhere, right?
Yeah, getting out of those, 25,
yeah,
25
it's a, yeah, the liquid. So you might be yielding very high, right? Cash on cash might be great. You might be getting it at a good cap rate. But getting out of that deal is a pain in the ass, right? Again,
yeah, we got someone yesterday. I think there was 35,000 people in the city, and it was 2 hours away from any major MSAs or cities, and that was the whole challenge.
Yeah, and plus you can't even find people there. You can't recruit anyone. If you do, that person leaves. Mm-hmm. So that's not my area of expertise. So in regards to exit strategies, look, a lot of what we're trying to do, which again is becoming harder and harder, is trying to find true value add. So not, hey, the broker says, you know, they've done all the work, but you can take it to the next level. No. Fuck that. I don't know if I can say that. Sorry. you can censor it later. What basically mean is, you know, there's something substantially left to be done. So as an example, on this deal, this is an 89 or 88 vintage, something like that. Nothing had really been done for the past 20, 30 years. Now, the owners were really good that they took care of a lot of the stuff along the way. So they've taken good care of the property. But at the end of the day, if something's 25, 30 years old, it's going to be dated. That's just the way it is. And the comp right across the street, or kind of two whatever streets across, basically is about a 1991 vintage. And the reason why they're getting an extra $300 to $400 in rents are straight up because over the past 3 years, they put in like $3.5 million into the property. So you can see, like night and day difference, right?
Right.
So that's the type of property we're looking for, right? Where we can actually go and roll up our sleeves and do a lot of the interior and parts of the exterior actually work. But again, they're becoming harder and harder to find. And what do you do on the exit? Look, there's a couple of options. Me, I'm so far at least a proponent that, look, if I was the only investor, right, and I am going to hold this forever. So my family's owned some commercial real estate for the past 50 years, the same assets, right? But we are the only owner, so we don't have outside pressure, right? Hey, sell this or do this or do that. In that particular case, I'm a big proponent that, hey, close your eyes, get HUD or agency financing and just go to sleep. Right? I mean, why you want to bother with this stuff?
Right.
But if you're a typical syndicator, look, the whole deal is you're trying to get out in 2 years or 3 years. Well, I mean, some version of that. I know everybody underwrites to five. They're trying to get out in 2 or 3. And if they say otherwise, they're just lying to your face. Right? I mean, that's just the way it is. Right? So if you're trying to get out in 2 or 3 years, you kind of have to go with a bridge loan. Because if you don't, all the value you create, you know, all the hard work you guys do day in and day out, that's going to get crushed by the prepayment penalties you're going to end up paying. So, I mean, what's the point? You did all this work for 2 years and then the bank makes all the money? I mean, what's the point of you doing this, right? So typically for us, we start with the bridge, but again, meat has to be on the bone, because if there's no meat on the bone, you can't be a cowboy, put a bridge debt on a stabilized asset, because then you're really playing with fire,
right?
So you stabilize that, get the NOI, all that operational stuff up, and about, say, if you have a 3+1+1, so really around the 18-month mark, you try to think, okay, now do I want to refinance it? Do I want to sell it? What do I want to do? And start preparing your asset in the next 6 months for either of these possibilities. And then when you get to that stage, you can decide, hey, do I want to refinance it? Depending on, you know, what terms you get. Because look, if you can refinance it and get 60 to 80% of your money out, I know that's hard these days, but that's as you need to, right? Well, hell, you take that deal all day, every day, man. You just close your eyes, you take 60 to 80% of your money back, plus the pref you've been paying your investors. And that's what is it? Even if it's at 70%, that's an 8% pref for 2 years, that's 86% of your money you took off the table. And by the way, this is a tax efficient way because refinance is a return off capital, right? So you're not paying any money on this money coming in, right? And then you can put them into agency debt. Or if some drunk guy comes in and gives you more money than you ever think this is going to be worth, well, you sell it because everything's for sale, right? But why? My point is, why back yourself into a corner when you don't have to back yourself into a corner? So just like, you know, we want operational flexibility. We also want lending flexibility.
Yeah. And it's also your cost of capital too. If you're using bridge, you're able to finance a lot of the CapEx, and on a true value add, you probably have a pretty substantial amount of CapEx aside.
Yeah.
And that 5% money, 6% money, however much it turns out to be, depending on rates, is much
cheaper. It's not even that. I can tell you this right now. We're closing right now. LIBOR plus 275, which is whatever, 4.55.
Right.
Four point whatever.
So it's cheaper than ever, right? And you're comparing that against investors. A lot of times have an appetite for 13%, 15%, something along those lines. So it makes a dramatic difference.
I mean, right now, all day, every day, somebody gives you like debt at below 5% with pretty much no constraints. Pretty much. I mean, there's some, but not a lot. You can close your eyes, man. Go for it.
Yep.
100%. But what are you guys seeing? What are you guys doing? Because everybody has a different business model, right?
No, well, it's a really good question. And I think that this is a topic that we've been talking a whole lot about. We saw one recently in Atlanta, actually, that was just over a 4 cap that seemed to be a, you know, kind of a stabilized, you know, C-class deal, right? And we've been looking at, we see stuff like that in Nashville pretty frequently. You know, a lot of
Nashville's on fire, man. I love Nashville, but it's on fire, man.
Yeah. And although debt right now is low, and that's part of the reason for cap rates being low, it's not that much lower than cap rates are. And I think one thing we've been noticing a whole lot is that the nicer quality assets, right? Cap rates are supposed to be a measurement that reflects the risk of the asset. And when you're seeing stuff that's more so stabilized, that's a C-class stuff, it's going to, you know, there's going to be a ton of CapEx exposure and risk that can come up, and you're seeing it trading at a cap rate that is maybe 25 basis points higher, 50 basis points higher than what you're seeing A class.
Yeah.
Maybe more so like the B plus stuff, right? Anything built in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. I think it's definitely had our, you know, had us looking at some of the newer assets as well.
Yeah, look, that's why I moved up market. I was like, dude, what's the point? I'm going to deal with a lower income tenant base. I'm going to take all their headaches on top of my headaches that I have in my life.
And it's a real thing. There's a lot of headaches that come along with that, right? We've dealt with all kinds of things from you know, crimes, from major delinquency, from leaving the apartments a mess, higher turn costs, right? There's a lot of, and then you, not to mention plumbing and roofs and everything else that comes along with it. So that,
and you know, just on that point, delinquency is so sky high in these C properties because people can up and leave, and what are you going to do? Ding their credit report? They already got shitty credit.
Right.
What is that going to hurt them? They're not going to go buy it, like the Mercedes they weren't going to plan on buying anyways. I mean, you know, that's a big issue. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, and I think that's just a huge piece too. Like the delinquency is once they're out, they're gone, on to the next one.
Dude, best of luck collecting that money, man. That shit never comes back, man.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it might come back for you guys, but my God, the amount of brain power you have to spend just to get even a dollar out of these people is, it's just not worth it.
No, not at all. Right. Yeah. You definitely lose a lot of slippage there. And that's a big.
And just, it's just frustrating, right? Because you're like, dude, you owe me the money. It's not the other way around. Why am I chasing you?
Yeah.
You're the one who owes me the money. It's not me giving, wanting to, you know. But it is what it is. What are you going to do about it? Exactly.
So on the topic, what do you think the biggest risks that people are taking on right now, they're going to leave them exposed if the market does shake up?
They don't have enough liquidity, man. All my partners hated me for saying this 2 years or three or whatever when we were doing our deals. And I would try to raise gobs of extra money. And everybody would be bitching at me, including all my equity partners. Well, you know, because look, in some way they're right. Look, it's dead money. You're not going to use it. Then you're going to have to keep paying a pref on it. Why do you want to do it? Or, well, it's going to hurt our numbers, which I guess it kind of makes sense. And I was like, yeah, but I prefer to go to sleep at night. So liquidity, I think, is the biggest thing. Because my point is, look, as long as you've got liquidity, even if it's a shitty market, I mean, again, all things being equal, right? You can't just fall off a cliff mm-hmm. like this. Man, if you got enough cash coming through the system or you have enough of a cash reserve, you can always find a way through the problems. Because we live in America, man. We don't live in Zimbabwe. These are recessions. And in like 6 months, a year, 2 years, look, even 2008, by around 2010, 2011, this thing starts flushing through the system, right? That's why you have all these people becoming big household names now, because syndicators, they crushed it from 2011 onwards. So, I mean, if you can survive for like a year, year and a half, dude, you're golden, man. So not having enough liquidity, it's the same thing, for instance, that all personal finance people tell, you know, when you're trying to run your household budget, right? When you guys have a wife and a kid and all that boring kind of stuff, you know, keep like 3 to 6 months of extra money, cash aside. Now, a lot of people think, well, I don't invest it. I'm losing whatever money. And you're like, no, that's not the point. The point is that in case things go south, you're not brushed into a corner. You don't do stupid things. You've got enough time to think, take a breather and just kind of figure things out.
Yeah, that's what we're working on now, building up the liquidity before we take on that kind of risk.
Yeah, and look, you're always going to be playing that game, right? Like, do I have enough money or should I invest this money? Because if I don't invest this money, then I don't make enough money, which will then give me the cash flow. So it's like a circular reference.
It is. No, it's a really good point, right? Because the numbers on a spreadsheet always look better when you have less money raised up front. But at the same time, you know, you're really measuring the risk and the last position you ever want to find yourself in, the one way you really get hurt in this business is when you're a forced seller. So it's liquidity and just watching to make sure.
And you're typically a forced seller when the times are bad. You're never a forced seller when the times are good.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So you get hit both ways. A, you're forced to sell and the market is shitty. So both ways you get hit.
Right. I think I've heard that it's risk is the silent player. It's always in the game, but you only see it when things are shaky.
Yeah. And the other point is just because you don't see something doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly. So a lot of people forget that also.
Exactly.
How do you mitigate your exposure to the stuff that you don't see that are in your
life? Dude, raise a lot of cash, man. Honestly, some of the offers, like, I just don't know what I don't know, man. And frankly, I also don't have enough brain power, unlike, say, an Elon Musk or a Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, all these people you hear about in the news, to kind of just sit down and write this massive, awesome computer program, because I also don't know programming, so that also kind of doesn't help me. You know, to just kind of figure out the world, right? I just don't know what I don't know. And frankly, I also don't care enough about the world. So my solution to that is, look, try to be in a position where you don't bite off more than you can chew, especially with other people's money. With your money, you can do whatever you want to do, right? Don't try to bite off more than you can chew. Always have enough liquidity sloshing through the system and always have at least, and again, always again is a bad word because, you know, we keep learning as we go along and we make mistakes and we don't do them again, hopefully in the future, but always have at least a 6 to 9 month glide path, right? Because 6 to 9 months basically means that, think about it this way, if you were to go sell something, even if it's a bad market, even if the broker is your best friend and he wants to help you out, whatever, right? The broker still needs a few months because he's going to come in, he's going to give you a BOB, tell you to tighten up a few things, right? Just to kind of present the story better. That's going to take you presumably 2 or 3 months or maybe 2 months if everything is good, right? And then they're going to go through a marketing process. That's probably going to take a month. And then on top of that, it's if it's a 60-day closing, that's if you're lucky, right? I mean, everything works. This is like everything is bam, bam, bam. So that's, what is it? 2, 1, 2. That's 5 months right there. And this is like assuming everything is working smoothly. Like you are just like a well-oiled, and nothing ever works smoothly, right? So let's be clear, right? So you got to have at least 6 to 9 months, ideally a year, where you're kind of looking forward and saying, do I have enough cash in case things fall off a cliff? And I got to pay my investors and I got to pay my lender. Or do I have enough to mitigate that? And then after that, you know, you can kind of figure it out.
Yeah. It would be nice if investors would be more accepting of just having the cash flows roll back in to build up the reserves at a higher pace. But I think it's a very, in a perfect world for us as sponsors, but I think it's a very hard thing to actually set the expectations because
You think it'd be better? I personally think investors, like, this was one of the learnings that I've had in the past few years. And I feel retail investors are far too forgiving, actually. It's actually very shocking to me because coming from a different type of, you know, cutthroat sort of person industry.
Sure.
I just thought like retail investors would be a lot more on people's ass. Like, for instance, because I invest in other people's deals, right? You know, me and my wife, we got some money, we want to invest in other people's deals. We invest in our own, but, you know, we do a few, only a few deals here, right? And I a lot of times email guys and be like, look, man, this, like, you're saying this, but literally what you're saying, your numbers are saying the exact opposite of this. So I'm not trying to be nitpicky here, but maybe you give me some context. I'm a sponsor. I know things happen.
Yeah.
Just trying to ask what the context is. And I've literally had guys who've been upfront and honest, so I'll give them that. And they straight up tell me, yeah, most of my investors are like, yeah, it doesn't worry. It's a bad time. Don't worry about it. I was like, really? People give you their money and now they're kind of just chilling? Like, hey, don't worry about it? So I personally think a lot of retail investors are far too forgiving, actually. I mean, I'm forgiving because I'm also a sponsor, so I understand the pain. But
yeah,
it's been an eye-opener for me. I did not think people were that empathetic and forgiving, which is a good thing, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah,
and you mentioned working with the retail investors. I guess, how did your background working at the institutional route shape your path towards real estate today?
Well, look, guys, in my particular case, what had happened is there was a couple of things. My family owns a lot of commercial real estate. It's part of their portfolio. It's not their thing. You know, they're not real estate people. They just own it, you know, for the past few generations. Yeah. But I was structuring a lot of deals. So in terms of valuations, restructurings, all of that kind of stuff, I had a pretty good grasp of things. Again, depends on what industry you're in, right? Every industry is kind of different. So how it helped me was to understand the technical and operational side of things. And again, that learning, you never stop. You keep improving that learning, right? The more deeper you dig in. But from a capital raising perspective, I realized that I was focusing a lot on, say, the numbers and say, I give you a dollar, how many dollars you give me back, what's the time frame, all of that kind of stuff. And retail investors don't necessarily care as much about that. Everybody says they look at the numbers, nobody really does, right? They care more about the stories and the narratives and how do you spin the story. So that was something that I had to learn, like how to present myself better for the audience that I was targeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just basic sales 101, but it took me a little while because I wasn't a sales professional to begin with. Yeah. Right. So you have to cater your message to the audience that you're dealing with. So understanding the operations and that, I think, gives me more credibility. Or that's what people have said. But again, I have had to learn how to deal with a different type of investor and present the same message, but in a manner that is they are more receptive to hearing.
Right. Yeah, it's a, what is it? Facts tell, stories sell, right?
I mean, yeah, story sell. Man. Sizzle sells, man.
Right. No, it's true, right? And there's definitely a lot more emotion involved. I think trust, right? I don't even know if it's not just
trust. Really, I think is the right word.
I think it's trust, really, right? I think it's people want to invest in people that they trust and sponsors that they trust, and some of that's a gut feeling. There's no way around that, right? And they because they're not going to take the time, oftentimes, to get familiar enough with the numbers to really be able to intelligently poke holes in them. So they're more, a lot of times, going off of the trust they have for you. But we also like to educate investors. I'm sure you do as well, the past investors, as far as what to look for as they're vetting deals from different sponsors. We always encourage other investors to look at several different sponsors so they can become better and make wiser choices as they continue to grow. If you're talking to a past investor, what are maybe two or three of the key things that you would encourage them to pay attention to when they're looking at a deal they're considering investing into?
So number one, look, before we go in, you know, the trust factor that you mentioned, mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest with you. I have invested with other people purely based off my trust with them. So I'm not saying I'm different. So trust was very important because at the end of the day, you don't want somebody who's extremely competent, but a crook, because you don't want a competent crook running your money. Right. So I have personally invested with people who I had a good relationship, and that's, most times it works and sometimes it hasn't, but that's just the way it is. Right. Nobody that's perfect. Right. But that being said, what are the couple of points? So a couple of points that I tell people, specifically investors, at least the ones I talk to, because we all attract different types of investors, right? Because you have to kind of match the investor personality with yours, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things that I tell people is, look, if you're talking with somebody, and you know, once you get over the initial parts of, hey, does this guy sound competent or is he a complete idiot? Right. Because if the person doesn't even pass that, then there's no need going forward.
Yeah. And right? Like you said, you need to get past the gut check. Right. But then
the basic gut check. Right. Right. Or if he's just like a used car salesman, just trying to sell you a product within the first 5 seconds of meeting you. Right. So once you get past the initial sort of gut check sort of deal, look, if somebody says they are an owner operator, as an example, right. Or a vertically integrated company like you guys are. Like, okay, ask them specific questions. Okay, on your operational side, when you have, say, particular interior units, because I'm assuming some of these are value-add stuff, right? When you have particular interior units, okay, can you kind of walk me through what's a typical ROI on the last few projects by unit type? What was the rent bump you were seeing? Why did you see that rent drop? And was it, for instance, different? And rather that, plus basically, what was the learning you had? Because I'll give you an example. On the deal we did in Jacksonville, we thought one bedrooms can crush it, okay? And it was the exact opposite. What happened is, mm-hmm. on one bedrooms, we have like a 7 or 14 or whatever it is, 8% ROI on the amount of money we've invested. But on the twos and threes, man, we're at 69%, 75%. And we never thought on the twos and threes we'd get that high, right? So that was a learning. But my point is, we only knew this after the fact to ask these types of specific questions. And a lot of right. times, you're not necessarily looking for a number like 14% or 20%. What you're really looking for is a thought process behind this, right? And is the person answering specifically? Or are they very loosey-goosey kind of way, yeah, well, we did that and we did this and we did rehab. Okay, what did you do in rehab? Two-tone paints, USB ports, lighting. You know, yeah. because you'd be very surprised. A lot of people can't even answer that. And the reason why they can't answer it, because they don't know and they don't track it and they don't care. They just want your money and that's it, mm-hmm. right? But on top of that, not as a shameless plug, I've also written about this on my blog. So you can literally, it's called something like, what is it? How to vet a multifamily deal sponsor. I mean, I'll give you the link. You can put it in the show notes, mm-hmm. right? A lot of this boils down to their track record on top of that. Then basically, what kind of bench strength do they have? So these are just some guys starting out. Look, we've all had to start out. So I'm not saying don't do that. Don't invest with those people. But you're looking for bench strength. Like how good is somebody's team around them? Because even if this person is a superstar, they are unable, nobody's able to do everything by themselves. It's just not going to happen. There's not enough hours in the day and there's too many items. So see the bench strength, see the team, but ask very specific questions. And if somebody cannot answer a question, ask them again, present it again, right? Maybe they didn't get it the first time. We all, that happens to us. But if they purposefully don't answer it, that also is your answer. Because this means this person doesn't know what he's doing and he's just a scam artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the end of the day, and all the people that I've invested with, they were all through referrals.
Yep.
Nobody, I didn't ever go to somebody's website and be like, oh, this guy sounds great.
Right.
Give him all my money. You know, yeah. It's always through referrals.
Yeah. And I'm a big believer that this is always going to be a relationship-based business, yeah. regardless of how many crowd streets or real crowds and different funding sites pop up left and right. I think that you're always best off having some kind of a referral base when you're being introduced to a sponsor. It goes such a long way. And I think the points you bring up are very, very important, largely due to the idea that the asset management is such a large part of this. I know it is something you stress, having someone that's a qualified asset manager behind the scenes operating, because otherwise problems can emerge and someone not experienced may never notice them, right? And they may continue.
Oh, yeah. And look, to be honest with you, look, if you're buying these 20, 25, 30 million, whatever, 10, 15, whatever it is, $5 million asset, right? In a way, you're buying like a 5, 10, 15, 20, $30 million business.
Mm-hmm.
And a business requires that, you know, there's going to be some accounting and finance, some level of it. You need a controller, accountant, CPA, whatever. You're going to have some level of sales and marketing or business development. You're going to have some level of operations. So in my particular case, what I've noticed is that if somebody has a good accounting and finance background, like this bank, if they're a CPA or they know how to audit the books, they know how to run their way through a P&L, they know how to do basic modeling, versus somebody who just has a real estate experience, so, you know, whatever that means. I would much rather take the guy who has accounting and finance experience, because they can easily at least get a grasp, big picture wise, of some level of operations in these bigger assets. So we're not talking buying a house here, right? Compared to like these traditional old school real estate guys who just want to fly by the seat of their pants. I would much rather take a CPA, CFA, because I know they can cross over pretty easily. Not 100%, but to a certain degree, but they can manage to numbers and manage to expectations and manage by their P&L, and they live and die by their P&L.
Mm-hmm.
Versus some guy who has no idea about accounting and finance and who's just flying by the seat of his pants.
That's why Dylan asked if I got my CPA before joining.
Yeah.
Well, we have two CPAs there, so we have the accounting side covered.
Yeah, look, my point is, CPA is obviously a nice thing to have, but at least you need to know how to go through your P&L. You need to know when things have to be capitalized, when they have to be expensed,
yes.
how they have to be expensed, where can you get a draw against your lender, where can you not get a draw? How do you negotiate these things? What is your P&L? When you go audit all your receipts and all of this kind of, I mean, it sounds one-on-one level stuff, and it really is, because you don't really have to be a CPA to know this. But it does help. I mean, because then because a lot of times what I had is I've talked to the PM's controller and they'll try to throw out a big word out there, right? And most people will shut up and you're like, dude, look, first of all, that makes no fucking sense what you just said right now. You're a dumbass and you should stop talking right now. Number two, this still doesn't answer my question. Why did you choose to expense this thing when we could capitalize it to the lender? So you got to cut through people's bullshit, right? Right. Because a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll just throw things out there because they just want you off their back.
Yeah. And I right? think when you dive into those income statement line items, it's you're holding the team accountable because you have budgets in place and there's any major variances. And the P&Ls truly tell a story. So, if, you know, for us, if occupancy dips, we should see move-in fees and application fees go up because we're having more people process. So each piece tells a story and you can really dive deeper and the numbers truly tell a story. So I really resonated when you were telling your story of, hey, your story per this business plan is X, but the numbers say Y. Why is that different? Yeah. So it's definitely just a huge piece of trust, but verify.
Yeah, and the other thing also is, look, you're going to realize, you have property managers, but again, these are employees. You're going to realize a lot of times you're not trying to do this to be difficult. People just have to know. The fear of you being knowing how to do an audit and dig into the numbers is actually greater than the probability of you actually going and doing it. Mm-hmm. Right? So people have to know that if push comes to shove, you know how to filter through all the BS, get to the bottom point and hold people's feet to fire. So that fear in and of itself, a lot of time forces and compels people to do the right thing. Right? Because you have good internal controls.
I also think it's important for anyone that's building their own business and actively investing to never be in a position where you're fearful of feeling like you don't know the question, you're fearful of looking stupid in the space, because as you're communicating with the various team members you're going to have, whether it be your lawyers, your CPAs, your property managers, there's a lot of different lenders, right? There's so much. And you're never going to know everything. And you're not supposed to be an expert and to know everything. You're supposed to have a method of handling things you don't know, or a way of having them translate whatever you may be discussing to make sure you can wrap your head around it and fully understand it. So I think it's important to note to never be afraid of looking dumb, because I think it's that.
Well, I don't think they're looking dumb. I mean, I just, a lot of times when I don't know anything, I just tell people, hey, so what does this mean in English?
Right. Exactly.
Like, what does this really mean? Like, layman's break it term. Down. Yeah. Give it to me in layman's term. I don't know what you're saying. I really don't give a shit about this term. Explain this to me in plain English. What does this mean? And you're not dumb, because it's your money at the end of the day. So somebody can have an opinion that you're dumb. That's great. It's still your money.
I think it's the old saying, though, if you ask a question, you look dumb for a moment, but if you never ask it, you're dumb for a lifetime, right?
Yeah, so. That's a good one. I'm going to use that. That's nice. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
So what else you guys got going on? What are you guys doing to round out the year? A couple of projects you have going on?
Yeah, so for us, next couple of weeks are really just, like you said, tying up the year. Right now we're prepping 2020 budgets, so that's our big focus for the next week, is just finalizing all the budgets. By that, Mike's been doing a lot of work there. Any learning lessons you want to share?
I think just as a sponsor and as investors, that year-end review is the perfect time to reassess your assumptions. So when you're underwriting, you always assume, you know, a particular number is, you know, the go-to. But always reassess and take pulses. Things change. We've had utility bills in Kentucky update, which, you know, there's other factors when it comes to implementing RUBS. You know, it just really is a good time of year to reset and check those assumptions and see what's truly going on in the business instead of being in that theoretical underwriting world. So it's
I agree with you.
On both sides.
Yep, I agree with you. So what kind of tips can you give me now that I'm going forward in 2020? What, give me some Rand secrets. You should have a podcast called Rand Secrets, and I'm going to definitely subscribe.
Well, the Rand Secrets, we're waiting on those. Those might be a 2020 revelation we bring out to the world.
Is that Gino's new coaching product?
The Rand Secrets? Yeah. We can't give it all away for free, right? We have to.
Gino's still concocting something every day, and we don't even know it yet.
So. Okay, cool.
Another day, another product, another idea.
You can add it. What was the analogy you knew? It was a hub and spoke model you guys had. Was that the analogy?
The power wheel. Yeah.
The power wheel, yes. Yep. So, that could be another cog in the wheel. Or whatever, not cog wheel. Or whatever that means.
We have a few new guys join on the lending side of things, so we're super excited about that. And outside of that, we're
spitballing with the idea. I know it's something I think we spoke to you about a bit, is the idea of doing more of a fund method to basically provide a product that allows investors to be more diversified, probably targeting assets that we can consider to be longer term holds across the board, longer term fixed rate financing, really doing some testing to see what kind of interest and appetite our current base has for it. And if they're not, if they don't have the appetite, how do we continue to find folks that are, because they are out there, but I think it's just finding the right model that, that works for us, because being that we self-manage and we have the management company in-house, we'd like to be able to hold things a little bit longer, right? It's nice to not have to sell in 2 years if you're going to be hiring employees and building a team and trying to develop some level.
Yeah, you're always on that hamster wheel, right? Because you let this one, you got to get another one,
Right. So it's definitely something that we're just weighing up and just doing some brainstorming on what our strategy is moving forward. Because we're in the same boat. I think we realize that the market right now, pricing, there is some deals that, come across our desk every week or so that, are a little bit scary to see where pricing is going. It doesn't seem to be slowing down. We thought it may have softened a little bit a few months back, but it seems like, you know, it's continuing to go in the same direction. So just trying to adjust our strategy, being patient and seeing where.
And you see the same things in the market segment, like you're in Chattanooga, right?
We're in we're heavy in Knoxville, Tennessee, and then also Louisville and Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah. So you guys see the same pressures there as well?
Absolutely.
To the same degree. Okay.
Even in Louisville, we were, when we started buying there, I had several discussions with brokers that were along the lines of, hey, you know, a lot of people from out of state aren't used to buying here, right? Or, you know, there used to be like three main major buyers in the city that were all local that, would just trade all their assets all the time, right? And now, you know, we're in there. I'd say we got in a year and a half ago, but even since we've been in, we're coming to the point where there's a lot more out-of-state buyers. We're having New York brokers reach out and with clients that are looking to get their money out of New York with all the new rent control laws in place, and they're pouring money down south. They're looking at markets that really didn't have half as many eyes on them not too long ago. So it's definitely been interesting to watch even more of the, if you want to call them secondary markets or whatever you might want to call these MSAs, getting a lot of attention and you know, the cap rates getting compressed, not nearly to the point where they are in more of the major markets, but still definitely changing.
And no issues with exiting these properties? You feel it's okay? It's not as hard exiting these properties in smaller markets?
So,
or is it? I have no idea.
So right now we're not in anything that is too small of a market, right? We're in markets that are well over 100,000, several hundred thousand really in each market. So we are in markets that are wide enough. And I think if you're looking at over the next 12 months, I'd say it's pretty liquid. I think actually going through and doing it would tell us a little bit better, but we're seeing a lot of people showing interest in our properties. We're getting calls. We're seeing a lot of things trading in the markets. But the question is going to be, how liquid are they when things get tighter, right? Because there will probably always be people in certain markets around the country that have more demand, whereas these markets might be slower to trade. Maybe all the eyes will pour back into more of the primary. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Okay. Keep me posted. I can copy all your secrets in.
Yeah. One day.
Yeah.
Schedule you a call with Gino.
Yeah. But I'm too poor to afford all the coaching products, man. I got a kid to pay for, and whatever, like mother living expenses, two cars, man. I'm too poor. Gino deals with rich people who need coaching, man.
Hey, well, that's why we do the podcast. All right. Well, last thing, we always like to ask for one expert tip for active or passive investors. You already touched on one for passive investors, so let's touch on something for active investors. If you were to talk to yourself as you were just making the transition from working in finance at an institutional level to going into business for yourself, what's the one piece of advice you'd give yourself?
Well, start sooner, I guess. But you got to start. But that, look, I'm also 34, so I can say that. If you're 45, you got two kids, one going to college, you know, some version of that, or a divorce, God forbid, or some version of this, right? You're at a very different stage in life. So you better make sure, because what you can't do is, for instance, take again, like you can't just roll the dice. In my particular case, I did some of the finance stuff and everything, but my wife also happens to be a physician. So, you know, God forbid, hopefully things are going fine, but God forbid things don't work out. We have some income to rely on, right? I mean, it's not like we're going to hopefully go hungry. So you've always got to make sure that, because I see a lot of guys getting into the game or getting into things and like, dude, you got to have at least a couple of months worth of cash lying around, man, because it's not going to happen overnight. And the other deal is the thing a lot of folks don't, I guess, realize, or folks have told me this now that I'm in this. This is not a cash heavy business for the sponsor, like on a month by month basis, but this is a very lucrative business because there's a lot of equity built up, right? So you better have the cojones and the patience to wait for like, whatever, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And everybody says they're going to wait 2 years or 3 years because time flies. Yeah, it doesn't really fly when you're broke. You know, time like grinds to a halt when you're broke and you need cash today, right now. So it's easy to say you're going to wait 2 years and I have a long-term vision, but you better make sure right along the way you don't get divorced, your kids don't hate you, and you know, you have at least some semblance of sanity left, right? Because there's no use getting to the end of 2 years, getting your $2 or $3 or $4 million, and then everybody hates you and you got no friends.
Not to mention, very few sponsors starting off are ever truly diversified.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, like you're highly concentrated, right? So, I mean, those are risks, but those are risks that any business person has. But unlike a lot of businesses, there's not, I mean, you're not getting rich off the asset management fees. Let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. You're not flying to Europe on your asset management fees. So kind of take that into consideration before you take a deeper step in.
Love it.
Identifying the liquidity events and just making sure.
Yeah, it just kind of makes basic one-on-one level stuff, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Omar, what's the best way our listeners can reach out to you?
Well, you can go to our website, and right on the website, I made it really simple so even dummies like me can do this. Enter your name. Hopefully you know this. Enter your email. Hopefully you know that as well. And just and it says, how did you find out about us or whatever the third field is. And just type Rand Creek CRE Show, right? That will give you access to me. You can also email me, Umar@boardwalkwealth.com. So that B-O-A-R-D, walkwealth.com. And I'll get back to you. And honestly, if you have a question that I don't know the answer to, I'd be happy to connect you with somebody who does. But I know all the answers, so, you know.
Well, I definitely love the content you've been putting out there, too. If you're on Omar's list, you're able to see his lot of optimistic messages about the golden age of the markets that we're in and all the home runs he's seeing every week that come across his desk.
You know it, man. I'm just a cheerful kind of guy.
The poetic optimism of real estate.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, you touched on some of the stuff you put out there for passive investors as well. But I think you've had some articles I've seen teaching about how to read through a PPM and operating agreement and stuff like that. So I think, you know, definitely get a lot of content that folks should be willing and ready to check out. But yeah, there we have it. Another episode of the Rand CRE Show. We appreciate everyone for joining us here. And if you're interested in jumping on a call with us, if you have any additional questions after the show, you can reach out to us directly at either randcre.com or info@randcre.com. And make sure to leave us a nice rating, review, comment whenever you listen to the podcast. And we'll see you next week.
Have a good one, guys. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Have a good one. Bye.